Into sports.
20 yards out, Urs to shoot, don't shoot! Oh, what a goal from Fabinho! Wow!
Then get into the all-new OTB Sports app.
I think when he apologises to me, I probably will say hello to him, yeah. No.
Videos, sports news, live scores, interviews.
If Fabregas is going to come up to me in the street and give me some of the mouth that he would have given me on a football pitch, what would he do? He'd get a slap.
Plus, exclusive content on the OTB Podcast Network. The biggest names in sports. Ready when you are. Search OTB Sports on your App Store and download it now.
The OTB Podcast Network. With Green Farm on the go. Snack smart with 100% natural, protein-powered chicken bites.
Football on Off the Ball
with Paddy Power,
fueling the mischief in the beautiful game.
Gamble responsibly. See dunluey.net.
All right, you're very welcome back to Off the Ball this Monday evening. Neil Tracy here with you until 10 o'clock here on News Talk. Liverpool and Southampton kicking off at St Mary's at 8 o'clock. So Mark Lawrenson has joined us now to look ahead to that game. Evening, Mark. Happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year to you, Neil, too.
To recap on this Happy New Year, so how do you feel about Jordan Henderson and Fabinho starting in centre defence together?
Well, didn't Henderson play in the World Club Championship as a centre-back? If my memory serves me right, in the final. Listen, it's not a great issue because look at Southampton. They've not got a massive physical presence up front. Danny Ings, I think, is playing, isn't he? So he's got good movement and he's quick. So I wouldn't be worried too much. Both of these guys, I mean, Fabinho's found it really, really easy. But I think with both of them, if they do happen to make a mistake, they've got the power and the pace to recover. The only thing is you just don't know how they're going to go together in terms of, you know, the two of them as a partnership. And I would think that Henderson obviously will do lots and lots of the talking because that's his role, he's a captain, etc. So I'm pretty sure they'll be fine. I don't think Liverpool will play any different just because Henderson and Fabinho are playing as two centre-backs.
You sound relatively confident in general so this evening?
Well, listen, no, you know what? I've seen Southampton a few times this year. They're really good. They're like, if I dare say, they're a kind of smaller version of Liverpool because they press extremely well. The three forward players, all good, movement's great. Shea Evans is starting to look a proper player now as well. Redmond, all these guys, Ward-Prowse, they're good at the back. I think the manager's driven. The manager's a bit like Klopp in many, many respects in terms of the way he is with his team, the way he sets them up, and also the way that they press. So I don't think we're in for a game where the two teams are going to sit back and admire each other. I think they'll go for it, both of them.
Yeah, it was funny. Like 2 weeks ago, if we were to go back as far as then, after that Crystal Palace game, it didn't really feel like the opening game of 2021 for Liverpool against Southampton would carry the weight that it has all of a sudden. With the way they've dropped points over the last couple of games over Christmas, and Manchester United have come back into things. Man City have started to look like themselves again. All of a sudden, now, like there is pressure on this evening.
Yeah, there is. But I think we that some of us have been watching this for a long, long time and playing in this particular league, although under a different guise. Just know if you win the league 1 year by masses of points, it's always far more difficult the next. Chuck COVID into the mix, chuck the fact that, you know, no crowds, etc., there weren't the odd 2,000 here and there. No great pre-season as well for players. So it was always going to be close, and I think it will be. I think the thing with Liverpool is that West Brom at home and Newcastle away, look, they made enough chances probably to win four games. All right, they drew both of them, but it's very, very rare that they only score one goal, but also the fact that I think that, you know, that the front three don't really fire, which is most unusual. And you know what it's like, Neil, now with football is that if you're winning virtually every week and all of a sudden 1 week you draw or even lose, it's a calamity and it's a catastrophe. And we know it's not. It just isn't, because other teams will draw, other teams will lose. I would say there's probably five teams in with a shout of winning the league, but I think the top three or the best three in terms of winning it, I would go the two Manchester clubs and Liverpool.
Mm-hmm. As the days go by, like we had the West Brom game, I know you were on with us last week as well,
yeah,
talking leading up into the Newcastle game.
Is that West Brom result looking a bit more concerning ever since then, when you see how bad West Brom have been? Or have they just been two games where Liverpool could arguably still be out on the pitch right now playing those two games, and they're just days when the ball isn't going to hit the net again?
Yeah, I think it's the latter. I don't think there's any great problem. You know, West Brom basically played 6-4, didn't they? And they got away with it. And, you know, I think Klopp treated it in the right way, which is certainly publicly, which was, we've got a point more to our total. But I think privately he would have looked at all the videos, etc., and analysed everything. But, and the same with Newcastle. I mean, the goalkeeper, Darlow, was obviously allowed to play extremely well. In fact, he was outstanding. But that just shows you the number of chances that they made. But I think when you're in amongst it as well in those teams, it's just, you don't lose. That's the first thing, if you're not maybe firing on all cylinders. But it's not really an issue because, you know, Liverpool's form away from home hasn't been particularly good. But, hey, the top of the league, or last time I looked, they're still top of the league. So that's just the way that it is. I think everybody would love it this year or this season to be five teams on the last day, all with a chance of winning the league. I don't think it will, but I think it might be two or three very, very close in terms of games towards the end of the season where, you know, one of the three can win it. And that would be great for the neutral. And if it were Liverpool again, well, fantastic. And, you know, a lot of people always said about all the players that they're missing, etc. But it really, there's not too many players that would come back into the team. Of course, the two centre-backs would come back. I can't think of too many others. So they aren't really missing that many important players, and the front three are all fit. And oh my goodness, I mean, the front three for over 3 years now have just been absolutely incredible. They really seriously have.
You said, you know, they aren't missing too many other players aside from centre-back. Someone they had been missing came back against Newcastle off the bench, starting this evening, Thiago. When he came on against Newcastle, I know, as we were saying, they could still be there this evening, and it just felt like they weren't going to score, but he was absolutely sublime for the bit he was on the pitch last week.
Oh, he's a class act. He's absolutely, totally a class act. My only worry is because of his age, he might be, you know, they have a saying in the game a little bit, which was, you know, which is, he's made of glass, that, you know, he can get injured. Quite a lot. I mean, he's already been injured on a couple of occasions. It's not his fault. It's just the way that it is. Matip's the other one. Matip's another one that's made of glass a little bit and misses an awful lot of games. The great thing for Liverpool, I mean, Oxlade-Chamberlain's starting tonight, isn't he? So, you know, the great thing for Liverpool is that they've got all these players that can come in and play in different positions. They, whatever team he picks as well with Klopp, this is the thing, is it doesn't change the way that they play, regardless how many are missing. It's all the same. It's press, it's press, it's press, it's press. And as we've seen from majority of the teams, it's very, very difficult to deal with. And that's probably why Hasselhoedl has looked at his players and thought, that's why we're going to play. And he's done it. He's mirrored them in many, many ways.
You mentioned the away form there. So just two away wins this season, three draws in the last four on the road. Those three draws as well being Fulham, Newcastle and Brighton, like three games you should be expecting to win. Like, I know you're saying that they are still top of the table, they haven't been losing games, but they are significant dropped points against teams that you absolutely should be beating.
Well, you should be, but you're not, and you are still top of the league. But also the other thing is as well is that, you know, we are looking at this Liverpool team, and what we're doing with it is we're not comparing it against all the others. We're comparing it against the way they were last season, which was just phenomenal, and the number of points they got the season before. And I think the history of the Premier League and the old Division One is you might run away with it 1 year. You might even, you know, the second year get loads of points in front of people, but the third year you don't, and it's a scrap. And basically, that's the way that it is. And it's not as though people have suddenly found out the way that Liverpool play, because we've known virtually within 6 months of Klopp taking over the job, this, you know, the whole pressing thing was the big thing. And I know what you're saying, but it's not, you know, when you're kind of within the camp and looking, and you're saying, you don't say, oh, we're not playing very well and we only keep drawing and we should be doing this, we should be doing that. It's like, and especially at the moment with so many games, you just keep rolling. And that's the way that it is. And I think I think privately that Klopp, and I don't think he'll admit this, but he knows it's going to be different this year. Well, it already is, but he knows, and he knew at the start of the season that it would be different because, you know, they've been on such a high, and also the situation which they're playing the games now as well. And if you say that last year they were totally at 100%, you might say at the moment they might be kind of 75, 80. So there is that chance to go higher in terms of percentage, but they also might drop a little bit. But I just think that's the way that the league's going to be. I think home advantage counts for very little generally in the Premier League, which was seen by results. So we're going to have strange results throughout the course of the season for me. And even with the top teams playing, not so much the very bottom teams, but, you know, from kind of 16 upwards, it's going to be some crazy results still.
Yeah, we had commentary of the Chelsea-Man City game yesterday, Man City's 3-1 win, and it was something that came up after the game that so Man City now up to 29 points. They're four back from Liverpool and Man United, but they have a game in hand heading into this evening as well. If there was one team in that kind of bunch of about six or seven within touching distance of Liverpool, would Man City be the one that Jurgen Klopp might actually be seriously looking over his shoulder a bit at?
Yeah. I mean, Manchester City, we're looking at them. Sorry, Manchester United, we're looking at them and got lots of match winners yet. Had a really good run yet. Does it look like the teams can get at them? Absolutely, totally. I was at Old Trafford the other night, doing the game. And Villa were a little bit unlucky in the end, not to get a point. OK, Man United did deserve to win, but Villa were unlucky. So, look, the thing with Manchester City, they've got top players, and you'd argue that maybe their second best player after De Bruyne, Aguero, is still to come back in the side and get fit and running and scoring. So I think, you know, they've looked a little bit different, Manchester City, this season. They've looked almost like, without Aguero in the team, it looks like the midfield players are kind of thinking, crikey, we can't really pass it into Jesus, we can't do this, we can't do that. And they've been a little bit kind of almost standoffish, but you know that if they click, and I mean, they've gone quite a long run now as well unbeaten, haven't they? But if they click, they're capable of beating absolutely any team in the league. And they're also capable of putting three, four or five past you, most of you.
Mm-hmm. And on City then as well, like, City and Liverpool meet on the 6th of February. City's Premier League fixtures leading up to that game. So we've Brighton, Palace, Villa, West Brom, Sheffield United and Burnley. It's entirely conceivable they're winning six out of six, or, you know, five out of six leading into that game. Before Liverpool play Man City, they still have to play United and Spurs in that time as well. Like, that game on the 6th of February, it's entirely conceivable Man City could be ahead of Liverpool at that stage.
Yeah, could be. Could well be. But in all honesty, I don't think it'll affect the way that Liverpool play. It certainly won't affect the way that Manchester City play. So I'm presuming then, after the run of fixtures you've told me about with City, they're going to have a run of tough fixtures. So you've got to play everybody. You've got to play everybody twice. And I know when we look at these games, and you hate that thing, it's a six-pointer, it's all that kind of stuff, which it kind of is and it isn't, isn't it? So, look, and I think also it's so early in the new year. I mean, even early first week in February when City play Liverpool, awful lot of games to play. Who knows Champions League where they will be, because obviously that starts a few weeks after as well. So, look, you know, I do think Liverpool will win it. I think it'll be really close, and I do think the only real other teams have got a chance. City would be the next, and then Manchester United. Look at Chelsea and think, not ready yet. Don't know the best team. You can't lose. Is it three games out of four or four games out of five? That you can't do that and win the league. Arsenal not good enough. Tottenham will still be a little bit. Mourinho's team, which is never really takes the handbrake off. So, although I think all those teams will be in the top five and maybe you might chuck Leicester in, I think, you know, Liverpool for me, City very close and Manchester United not far behind.
So do you think we have a three-way shootout heading down the... If we're talking maybe from March onwards, when teams start to kind of break clear a little bit, I think most people would expect Liverpool, Man City... Do you think United are in that trio, or are they in a best of the rest at the moment?
No, I do, Neil. And in fairness to Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, you know, when they were struggling a little bit at the start of the season, he said, look, you know, our preparation, we're miles behind. And we all thought, yeah, it's just an excuse. But looking at the way they've progressed, I think it wasn't an excuse. Their preparation was miles behind. And also, maybe even now he still really doesn't know his best team. I mean, he played kind of Pogba on the left of a diamond the other night. He doesn't really want to play there because he's inside all the time. And he let Aston Villa's right back through on a few occasions. So he's still very much the manager looking for his best team. But, you know, all the while, he's got lots of players who can win games on their own. Really seriously has. And, you know, you might even argue he's probably got, maybe even got more than the likes of Liverpool and Man City in terms of actual match winners and somebody just to, you know, to score a goal out of nothing.
We have a text in here on our YouTube stream just referencing Jordan Henderson and Fabinho starting at centre-back today. Does this mean Klopp thinks that the available centre-backs aren't good enough?
Yeah. But I would also in my reply to you, I would say not good enough yet. They've all done all right. In fact, they've done well so far. But you know, he's looked at Southampton and thought pace, front three, loads of pace. So he's kind of thinking, okay, we don't really need a centre back who's particularly good in the air because that's not going to be the case. The way this game is, you watch now, Southampton will score from a corner.
They'll be pumping balls in all afternoon.
Yeah, but so he's thinking. He's thinking pace all over the pitch. That's what he's doing. Look, it's. If you're a player generally and you're a midfield player, you can play at the back. And a lot of the central defenders can play in midfield as well because everybody's far more cultured on the ball. It's much easier as well. And you don't really get the Joe Jordans and Mickey Harfords and all those kind of fellas who just wanted to knock you out in the first 20 minutes. That's all gone. And look at someone like Benteke at Crystal Palace. He's about 6'5". And playing against him, you think, oh my goodness, but he's not roughy toughy, is he? So that's all gone. So it's not quite the deal that it was. And teams play from the back and they don't play 30, 40, 50 yard balls through to the centre forward, apart from maybe at times Burnley. And Liverpool play Burnley, I think, in a couple of weeks. So that'll be an interesting one.
Certainly will be. Do you expect them to get a bit of cover in defence though over the next few weeks?
Yeah, I think if there's anybody available that he wants. I mean, the thing with Jurgen Klopp, he's always waited. He's been prepared to wait. He waited for Alisson. He waited for Van Dijk, and everybody knows about the ability of those two and how fantastic they've been for the football club. And he's not one just to say, oh well, we'll take him just as cover. I don't think he's that kind of manager. He's thinking, well, what's the point? So,
but in the past, has that need not always been in the past that like they needed a long term option, like with Van Dijk, so they were happy to wait. Whereas now they kind of need bodies as much as they need, you know, a long term option because they know Van Dijk is good. They know Joe Gomez is good if and when he gets back fit again. But at the moment, it's just they're short on bodies, isn't it?
Yeah, a little bit. Lovren's gone, Annie, so you're probably talking only really through with Matip, and as we said before, he's a bit kind of made of glass. But it's also, you know, because he's got a fabulous dressing room, and it really seriously is, and, you know, it does a lot of work for him that managers at other clubs have to do for themselves. So he's got to think about that. And also, I mean, how does he sell it to somebody? If he wants to bring somebody in, but he doesn't think this person's going to play on a regular basis, how's he going to sell it to him apart from giving him a barrel full of money? So it's one of those, isn't it? I'm sure he'll be looking. I mean, the recruitment's been fabulous. That's one of the great things about Jurgen Klopp and the recruitment team in the last 2 to 3 years. The recruitment team has just been amazing when you think about it, because they've made very, very few stoomers over players. They'll be looking, they'll know. But I'm looking around and I'm thinking, well, who are they going to get? And also, the other thing with them as well, of course, is that, you know, we are in COVID. We're not kind of sure in terms of how long crowds aren't going to be let in. Teams are literally losing money hand over fist. So we'll wait and see. And you know that the guys from Boston have been brilliant with him, absolutely fabulous. And that, you know, they trust him so much. And you know, when he's always went to them for Alisson for $75 million, and they must have thought, oh my goodness. But you know, look what a player he's turned out. So they're backing, but it's, as I say, it's who you're going to get and what type of player you're going to get. And you don't really need one that's going to be, you know, that's going to be great in 18 months or brilliant in 18 months. You kind of need one now that can come in and play whenever.
Mm-hmm. Mark Lawrenson, thanks a million for joining us. Enjoy the game tonight.
Thank you.
Football on Off the Ball.
With Paddy Power. Fueling the mischief in the beautiful game. Gamble responsibly. CWE.net.
You're very welcome back to Off the Ball. Neil Tracy here with you for the next hour until 10 o'clock. It is football show time, and coming up, we'll be chatting to Pat Nevin very shortly, as well as Andy Mitten on Manchester United and Darren Fletcher's arrival into the coaching team. Latest score from St Mary's second half, about to get underway. Teams are on the pitch, so it is still Southampton leading Liverpool by a goal to nil. That goal for former Liverpool man Danny Ings quite early on, just 2.5 minutes into the game. Beautiful little chip over the top from James Ward-Prowse off a free kick. Caught Trent Alexander-Arnold napping, and it was Danny Ings just with a delicate little lob over into the far corner for over the head of Alisson, putting Southampton 1-0 up. Could have doubled the lead. Nathan Tella had a very good chance towards the end of the first half as well. But Liverpool dominating in possession, but probably the best chances of the game so far have fallen to Southampton. And as I say, we'll keep you updated on the rest of that game. Teams coming back out onto the pitch in the next minute or two for the second half. This would be a very significant result if Southampton were to hold on or indeed take a point. And there was also a very significant result yesterday at Stamford Bridge.
Comes to Zinchenko back inside Bowden. Bowden, a good one, and a shot, and he finds the net. It's a goal for Manchester City after just 18 minutes of action. As Vinny said, City have been turning the screw over the last few minutes. But that's some lovely play off the left wing, starting with Zinchenko, finishing with Gundogan, who blasts the ball past Mendy in the Chelsea goal. After 18 minutes, it's Chelsea 0, Manchester City 1. Plays it inside to De Bruyne to Foden. Foden on the attack now. Good tackle there by Silva, but it comes out to De Bruyne once more. Can he find the cross? He does, to Foden, and Foden finds the net. It's another goal for Manchester City. De Bruyne with the rebound, and De Bruyne puts it away. It's a third goal for Manchester City. Chelsea all at sea. This is incredible stuff. Raheem Sterling, it looked like he lost his chance, but the ball rebounded out to Kevin De Bruyne, and inside the box, no more lethal a man than he. 35 minutes, Chelsea 0, Manchester City 3.
Yeah, that was Chelsea losing 3-1 against Manchester City yesterday. Callum Hudson-Odoi's late goal putting a bit of gloss on the scoreline for Chelsea, but in reality that game was done by half-time. The gulf between the sides in that first half, pretty stark. Pat Nevin is with us for the next while, as usual, on a Monday evening. Pat, good evening and a very happy New Year.
And happy New Year to you, Neil, and everyone else listening as well, although I know it doesn't feel very happy at the moment for any of us, and we're getting into the lockdown over here as well, and it's not cheery times, it has to be said.
Yeah, no, the first few days of 2021, we were promised something a lot different to this. I think a lot of us just thought once the clock hit 12 o'clock on New Year's Eve 2021, it's all great again. But look, long year ahead of us, hopefully it gets a lot better than this. But let's start on something, I suppose, not so cheery for yourself or other people involved with Chelsea. Yesterday's defeat to Man City, like a 3-1 defeat to Man City on its own, it's not a disaster by any means, but it's just following the trend over the last 3 or 4 weeks where Chelsea have just started looking completely out of sorts.
Yeah, it was extraordinary how quickly it changed. It's hard to see the reasons why. I mean, certainly they miss Ziyech, he went out of the team, and then suddenly there looked to be a lack of creativity. But it did, it's not exactly imploded, but they've played quite a few games where they've had plenty of the ball, but they just haven't had a huge amount of creativity, and they've not been able to get through teams. And that's all bad enough, but then what happened in that brilliantly described first half there in the commentary? It was about 15 minutes in, I think, Chelsea were actually looking all right, started quite well. And then Man City changed, and they played the best football I've seen them playing for a year anyway. they had about 25 minutes where they were absolutely phenomenal. And it's kind of weird because I try to think about, you know, what would you have done if you were Frank Lampard? Because, you know, they lose that goal 1-0 and then they are overwhelmed in the midfield. Should he have changed it? Should he have, because they're playing 4-3-3. And if you're playing 4-3-3, your central midfielder can be overrun, and Kante was. Kante was completely overrun there. It's dead easy. You change that to a 4-2-3-1, you get two players in there and you kill it a bit. But Frank's attitude's always go and attack, try and get it back, and that's normal. But it just didn't work. And by the time the third one went in, again, you looked at Chelsea and they looked naive, they looked no open, they looked, you know, they just looked as if they didn't know where to go, and they were looking around each other. There was no confidence in the team. The youthfulness of the players suddenly showed up, and it just looked so extremely opposite of what Manchester City were showing at the time, which was brilliant game management and brilliant technical play.
Yeah, it's funny, like you were saying there, like, what does Frank Lampard change? Does he try to get another midfielder in there to kind of just tighten things up and create more bodies? But I suppose, like, as you mentioned as well at the start, for the first 10 to 15 minutes before the goal, Chelsea, you know, they looked very good. They were comfortable. They probably created the better chances, and it was probably a case of no sooner had the first goal gone in, maybe Frank Lampard is thinking, okay, we've played okay up until this point, we can work our way back in. The second one is in within 2 minutes, and all of a sudden then you're into borderline damage limitation mode.
Yeah, but even Frank Lampard, that's the way he is. He'll still think, no, we'll go at this. You know, we had a bit of the game, we'll keep on going at it. He's at home. It doesn't make a great deal of difference these days, but he thought, but I think it's the third one. And he thinks, oh my goodness. And then he realises that his team's not passing well, no one's playing well, no one's passing well. And that can happen. You know, confidence just seemed to completely flood out of the team, and which is not going to be easy for them anyway, because they've not, as you mentioned before, been playing well before that. But they're not the only team this has happened to this season. That's the point. Almost every team has had a period where this has happened, and you just think, wait a minute, you were great about 3 weeks ago. And suddenly you go, what? And I was talking to Joe about 4 or 5 weeks ago, and the conversation was the same one we're having about Frank, we're having about Ole Gunnar Solskjaer.
Yeah.
And I was saying, I think Ole's doing okay. I think, you know, I think the kind of basics are all right. You know, and they'd had a couple of bad results that were, you know, particularly in Europe. The basics kind of seemed all right, and they certainly had a decent enough squad. And I wasn't jumping on any bandwagons on Ole Gunnar Solskjaer. And to be honest, I'm not going to do the same with Frank. I'm not going to do that with Frank either, because, you know, it has been a stinking little period. And two or three, that particularly the Arsenal performance was a bad one as well. But you know, with this season, it's just as likely they could go on a great run, because they've got plenty of decent players there, and it could work. But that's the big thing. It could work just now. Who knows what's going to happen, because this league is just the wildest of the wildest. Funnily enough, the last game I was at before that was the West Brom, or the Liverpool versus West Brom one. And at half-time, honestly, as a pundit, you're watching a game of football and you're thinking, right, you're hopeless, West Brom. My line on it was, if West Brom defend any deeper, they'll be at Everton. They were that way, right back there. And then the second half, what happened? They got it back. And that's the madness of this season, trying to figure out what's going to happen. You know, it's extraordinarily difficult.
Yeah, and it's funny, like you mentioned that Liverpool-West Brom game as well. I remember I was presenting that Sunday and we had commentary of it as well. And that was, you know, they were the similar lines that we were talking about as well before that game. And even we were looking ahead at the fixtures Liverpool had, where we were going, okay, they've got West Brom, Newcastle, Southampton, that's a winnable one as well. And, you know, we were talking about how they were the one team that kind of didn't look like imploding anytime soon. And I know they're not imploding at the moment, but a couple of draws and a defeat and all of a sudden you've United picking up a few games. It just has been a completely wild season in that regard, where I think I saw a couple of people saying it's similar enough to maybe like what a championship season normally is, where any team all of a sudden, if they pick up 4 or 5 wins in a row, they're right up there all of a sudden.
Well, you just look at it, what it's been for the last number of years. Obviously, we're looking at what happens. You know, Man City had a brilliant run for a few years. Liverpool have had a great run for a few years. It was a period where Chelsea kind of half ran away with it as well. So we've got used to the fact that somebody's going to be a class above and run away from it. But, you know, it's not always been that. You know, there have been times where there's been a really good reaction with a lot of teams. And I think a lot of teams have just decided, right, there's weaknesses in everybody. And you're talking about Liverpool. If Liverpool, they're 1-0 down just now. If they don't win tonight, that's them 13 points out of 24. That's rubbish. It is, isn't it? I mean, I have every suspicion that they could get something back here, and they're attacking constantly at the moment and start of the second half. But, I mean, that is a difficulty of making these sort of predictions. So, but you know what it's like when we're talking about the, you know, if you go into the Chelsea websites just now, it's full of Chelsea fans, inverted commas, usually from overseas, who say St. Frank. And they were saying 3 weeks ago, give him a new contract. It's the bizarreness of this. And if you're organised a club, and if you're an executive or a chair or the decision maker, you've got to have a long-term perspective at the moment. I mean, because making judgments generally quickly is dangerous. The knee-jerk stuff is dangerous. However, at this particular season, with the weirdnesses of this, and it's for a multitude of reasons, you know, it's because of the weirdness of not people not being in, there's not been any pre-season, a number of teams are going through transitions, maybe specifically Chelsea as much as anyone else. You make those snap decisions, you put up with that for the next 2, 3, 4 years. Someone said to me the other day there, you know, they should get rid of Havertz and Werner because they're not doing it right. And I'm thinking, yeah, remember a guy called Salah and De Bruyne weren't doing it for Chelsea and they got rid of them too. You just think, you really, if you've made some decisions and you feel you believe in them, you got to stick by them a period of time, and that's what they have to do. Chelsea haven't done that massively in the past. Oddly enough, I suspect they will stick by the manager this time.
Yeah, it was something I was going to put you there, but you kind of answered it as well. I hadn't really seen what the Chelsea fans themselves have been saying, but from what you're saying, there are plenty now that are starting to turn anyway, a few fans.
Yeah, and that's happened at the start of the season, and then they turned back. And you have to remember, when you say fans, it's in fans inverted commas. The people that turn up to Stamford Bridge when you can get in, they'd be absolutely behind the manager. You know, they'd be a bit grumpy, but they'd be absolutely fine with it. They'd accept it. Last season, the amount of them that said, you know, mid-table's fine with Frank because they just want the rebuild, and they know it's going to take a bit of time. But that's not what you hear when you go in social media particularly. And of course, if you go in wider media, newspapers and stuff, they're going to have to sell papers, for goodness sake. Or, you know, they're going to sell themselves. They're going to make that suggestion of Frank. It's a long way short of that yet. I mean, it is a long way short of that yet. I mean, having said that, it's still a horrible time. And his biggest concern is probably those two players I mentioned before, because Havertz cost a hell of a lot of money, and so did Timo Werner. And Havertz, up until, you know, come on the other day there, was actually having a horror show of a time. Maybe partly to do with the coronavirus that he suffered badly from. But maybe Werner, the one that's the problem. You know, you look at him and his goal scoring rate is absolutely amazing. And I've got a possible theory. Like, I'll throw this one at you, Neil. I'll have a go at you, right?
Go for us.
I've played with a lot of centre-forwards over the years, right? They were rotten, right? They were just weren't very good players, right? They just weren't very good players. We used to have a big joke, and most teams I played for, you do the seven-a-side on a Friday, right? And in the seven-a-side, you do the pick of teams. We always picked our star centre-forward last. He was the last pick every time. We picked a reserve goalie before we picked him because we all thought the centre-forwards couldn't play. But they could score, like, but that was it. We didn't think they were any good. And it's really funny. It's a big thing within football that we all thought that, right? And everybody, you look at in the telly now, and all you see is centre forwards doing the analysis, and everyone else is going, oh, for goodness sake, we didn't rate them guys with their tactics. And Werner's a kind of bit like that. His touch actually isn't any good. It's not a particularly good touch for a guy who costs a lot of money, a guy who's got an amazing amount of goals, scoring for Germany massively as well when he was over there. His touch is absolutely brilliant in front of the goal. Absolutely phenomenal. See, when he touches away from that, it's not great. It really isn't great, and it shows up really bad. I don't know if you've seen the other day. I was watching the match of the day two the other night, and I was shocked they never used this. You know, they do this too good, too bad.
Yeah.
Well, Timo Werner tried to take a corner and injured himself.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And you just thought, that's it. But see, if you said to me, will he go back and score like another 10, 15, maybe even 20 goals for the rest of the season? I'd say I wouldn't be surprised by that. Because you stick him in front of a goal with a chance when he's on that type of scoring form. He's as good as anybody. It's just not happening just now in that one area. And it shows up all the other areas.
So 56 minutes played, just to keep people updated on St. Mary's. Still Southampton 1, Liverpool 0. But as Pat was saying a couple of minutes ago as well, Liverpool really starting to create a good few chances here now. Nothing too clear cut, but plenty of half chances. They did have a penalty shout as well that I think went to VAR. A ball certainly came off a Southampton hand anyway, but it was judged that it was all right for the referee to wave play on. Pat, just to go back on Lampard there, like you were saying, you fully expect him to be given time at Chelsea, but, and you're saying as well, you know, there are people in the media, they need to sell papers, they need to get clicks on articles. It can't go unsaid that The Athletic, you know, they've been saying that, and others as well have said that Chelsea have, you know, they have the unwavering respect for Frank Lampard, but they have begun to, you know, explore other options, look through potential names. They're also saying that there are quite a few players that, you know, might be outside the tent with Frank Lampard, a couple of senior players, that there's a bit of tension there. Like, these sort of things, they don't come out of thin air, do they?
They sometimes do. Absolutely, sometimes do. There was plenty being said about, as I say, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, wasn't there? Before that, he was under that sort of massive pressure, and he didn't have Pogba inside.
But it's certainly believable that Solskjaer was under that pressure.
And possibly so, but was the get ready him? By the way, but I'm not deflecting the question in any way at all.
No,
the questions are very interesting and possible questions. There's a couple of ways to look at it. Number one, when I've been in that position of being an executive at a club, I always had my next plan ready. And it didn't matter how well the manager was doing. I always had the next, you know, possible two or three guys I was looking for in case this guy goes. Now, my reasoning was, if he goes, if there's a stinker of a time you need to get rid of him, you better be having the next guy ready, or the next two or three that you want to choose from. Make sure you know what you're looking for. That's just good planning. And the other side of it is, the club I was in, Motherwell, if the manager does really well, he's just as likely to go. And you better have your next guy ready anyway. So I was always planning ahead like that. So the possibility with the Athletic are saying they are keeping their eye and their, you know, keeping their ear at the ground and all that sort of stuff, that's actually perfectly reasonable. I wouldn't be surprised at that at all. Whether that then translates into he's under imminent danger, I would be surprised at that. I'd be really surprised at that. That would be far too early for a guy that got top four last season, which was way above the expectations. And also, if you look at the team he's got out there, that team's, the age groups of it are extraordinary. I mean, we keep on forgetting Havertz is 21. Just a kid, doesn't look like it. Costs a lot of money, but he's 21. You know, likes like Hudson-Odoi's 20. Even Pulisic, only 21. These guys, I don't expect them to come into the room for another 2 years yet. So whether Frank's still there or whoever's there, getting the very best out of half of that team, I still think it's a good deal of time away.
Is there I presume there has to be a threshold of what he has to achieve this season, and what is it, like a bare minimum? I mean, I'm sure if he goes on a run of losing 7, 8, 9, 10 games in a row, which is incredibly unlikely, he'd be shown the door. But for example, like if they finish fifth or sixth, get knocked out in the Champions League in the next round and don't really do anything in the FA Cup as well, like is that enough for him to still be there?
I wouldn't be surprised if he hung on with that. I really wouldn't. Okay. Because Champions League was always to get beyond the group stage, and he'd done that with ease. With a decent draw, but they've had a stinker of a draw in the Champions League, you know, you'd hope for them to get a little bit further. It's whether what the club was saying when they brought him in is what they actually feel. Now, when the club brought him in, they said, this is a long-term project. Like, I know everybody says that, but it's a long-term project. And he could have, like, you know, said, okay, fine, we'll buy certain types of players to slowly build up. Or he could have done what he did do, which is getting a lot of young players that will be, you know, at their best and growing together for 3 or 4 years. He's decided, big style, along with the club, to go down that route and also bring through, you know, we're talking about those young players, there's Tammy Abraham, there's James, all them. They're all early 20s, very early 20s as well. Now, he's actually done that, and they're delighted with that side of it. So I think he's probably got, he has got a lot more leeway than any manager before him for about, since the Roman era started. However, you are right, there is a limit that they won't take and they won't accept. I just wonder, you know, with no fans in there, does it change the dynamic? I mean, if the fans were in there and they turned a little bit, that would change it. That would make it more stressful and more pressured. With no fans in there, maybe less so.
Yeah, I think it's probably something people would have mentioned with Solskjaer as well, for example, when United were going through bad runs over the last few at times in the last few months, that the fact that there's no fans there, it kind of, there's a little less pressure at times. On the,
do you know, one last thing about Frank, would you say that one of the downsides for him is, do you know if he could say, I had a whole bunch of injuries, but they've not really been that massive injuries, and certainly not compared to other clubs. You know, had Havertz out for a while there in Ziyech. But apart from that, he's had a lot to choose from, a lot to choose from. I mean, he put a B team out against Seville, and they won. They absolutely hammered Seville over there, and that was basically their B team they put out. There's no lack of bodies there. There's no lack of personnel. There's no lack of quality there, and maybe that's one big thing that's kind of working against him. He's got to get the best out of that group.
Yeah, and is that part of the problem as well, that we're pretty much halfway through the Premier League season now, and it seems like he actually is still trying to figure out what the best 11 players are to go on a pitch.
I think I know. If I had a guess, I think I know what he wanted his best front three to be. And it was the front three that started at the weekend there. But he'd want them fit. He'd want them on form. He would like Havertz to be starting as well. He would like Mount to be starting as well. And probably Kante or whatever behind them. That's all settled. He's kind of happy with Thiago Silva for the moment. He's no problem with Reece James in it right back. He's actually, and the keeper's pretty happy with him as well. So I actually think he knows what they are. He just needs to get them all playing the very best. I'm pretty confident he knows what his best is or what he wants his best to be, because he would like to get a team that was, you know, be it Werner, be it Tammy Abraham, you know, it'll be either or. And as the years go by, what he needs them all to be firing now or quite soon anyway.
One last bit on Chelsea specifically. Were you at the game yesterday?
No, I was covering it for Chelsea TV.
Oh, yeah. I am curious to see, like, if when people are at games, when there is no crowd and you can hear everything, in those moments, maybe like with Man City scoring two goals in quick succession, or are they the moments where if you're in the ground, you can actually maybe, you can hear the tensions maybe between some players, or you can hear if people aren't getting on, or if you can, like, I would say, that game against Arsenal a couple of weeks back when Frank Lampard really went to town on the players, I would have been very curious to be there and be able to hear, like, what was he saying on the touchline throughout the match?
A couple of games, because I was at a couple of games with Chelsea where they had some fans in. So I was at those games, and I was at the European games. And the odd thing was, and it is a case, and you kind of know it as a player anyway, when things are going wrong, if it's quiet, you've got a problem. If they're all shouting and bawling and screaming and moaning at each other, that's generally not bad. That's all right, because at least they're showing enough. It's when it's quite quiet. That's the thing. That's the alarm bells go off all over the place when you hear it's quiet. When the only voice you hear is the manager shouting from the side, you've got a massive problem there. And that was the thing I was looking out for there. And part of the problem they've got Thiago Silva, who's come in, and he's very vocal. But the most vocal player that I had previous to that was the guy that's gone, David Luiz. He was the real vocal centre of it. The other one that's very vocal and is always talking is Jorginho. But Jorginho wasn't playing at the weekend there. So everybody always tells me, I happen to love Jorginho as a player. I love Kante as well. If I had a preference, I would play Jorginho deeper and Kante a little bit further forward. I'm very much on the outside of what most people feel about that. But it's because of the personalities as well as the play. The person that you need noises there, you need voices there, you need personalities there, and ones that everybody else, you know, knits around and believes in. And at the moment with Chelsea, the biggest one, Azpilicueta, when he's playing to some degree, he didn't have a great time. And Thiago Silva, but up middle to front, not a great deal there.
65 minutes now played at St Mary's, still Southampton 1, Liverpool 0. But it's pretty much all Liverpool, aside from, as I speak, Southampton on a counter-attack, but no, a tame shot there and straight into hands of Alisson from Danny Ings. But still Southampton 1-0 up, but Liverpool starting to turn the screw a little bit, although they did dominate the last two games against West Brom and Newcastle, but couldn't find those winning goals. On Man City, before we even move on as well, it was something you said right at the start as well, and it was what Vinnie Perth, who was on co-commentary with us yesterday, said it was what Mark Lawrence said earlier on. that performance yesterday, that kind of 30-minute period leading up to halftime, or 35 minutes, is probably as good as they have looked in 12 to 18 months.
Yeah, absolutely. 100%. And I mean, maybe the team I see most, with the exception of Chelsea, actually in the flesh, is Man City. I get to see them a lot. And they actually can be quite, you know, they can be quite dull. They can, you know, they can be a little bit slow in their movement, you know, certainly recently. And I felt that recently they've missed what David Silva used to give to them. But honestly, it was like watching them of old. The phenomenal confidence that was flowing through that team. The energy that they had was pretty astonishing as well. Everybody was on form. Now, it's the easiest thing in the world to do that when you're 2-3-0. Honestly, no idea how easy that is, because you feel as if you've got six more players in the field than the opposition. But take nothing away from them. They were absolutely brilliant in that game. And if they do keep on playing like that, they will win the league. But that's still a big if they're going to be able to do that. But they were as good as people think. And I don't think it was because Chelsea were poor. I think it was because they were great.
Yeah, and the opportunity is there for them as well, because before they play Liverpool on the 6th of February, their Premier League fixture list, Man City, Brighton, Palace, Villa, West Brom, Sheffield United and Burnley. Like, Liverpool, by the time they play Man City, they still have to play against Manchester United and Spurs as well. I know we said right at the start that teams just aren't able to win five or six games in a row at the moment. But if there's a fixtures list that you'd like five or six games in a row of, if you want to go on a run, there's some good ones there.
Well, the other thing is in blocks this season. And so every season is in blocks anyway. But for the teams that are in the Champions League, the blocks are important. Now, the block between the end of the Champions League group stage and the round of 16, etc., that's a massive block. You've got to make good use of that, because you've got little bits more rest than everybody else. When you get back into that, if you go deep into the tournament, you're knackered. You know, you are playing more games than everybody else. You're picking up more injuries. There is more tiredness. It is going to affect you. So you're absolutely right. If Man City can go on this brilliant run between now and that actually happening, it's going to be really tough for everyone else, because I think Liverpool, for all the fact that they're a fabulous team and they're wonderful to watch, strength and depth of squad, not even close to Manchester City, I don't think. And it could, but I haven't said that a couple of years in a row. Sometimes I always seem to manage to do it. But eventually it's got to catch up with them. You've got to think eventually it's got to catch up with them. And at the moment, it's already kind of catching up with them because of that that runoff, as I say, 13 and, I worked out there, if they don't win today, that'd be 13 and 24. And that's almost unthinkable for Liverpool, isn't it?
Yeah, it certainly is. They've just headed wide there as well. Before we let you go, Pat, obviously the sad passing of former Chelsea manager, former Manchester United manager and Scotland manager as well, Tommy Docherty, on New Year's Eve. Sad end to 2020. I know you were speaking to JP earlier today. He was someone you knew very well.
Yeah, it's stunning. I'll tell you a very strange story about him. I met the Doc first time. I must have been about 23, 24, and he'd obviously just finished management, but you know, a doyen of the game. We'd done a TV show together called Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, and within an hour I thought, I've met one of my best mates. I'm going to keep him as my best mate the rest of my life if he'll hang about with me. Honestly, just couldn't believe how much fun that guy was to sit. It was like sitting beside Billy Connolly or whatever, but not wanting anyone else to feel as if he was dominating it. He was always funny. He always wanted to hear your side, and he would spin off it. I love people like that. Anyway, I got 3 weeks later. My brother Tommy, he started up the sevens, the football sevens in Hong Kong, and he'd say to me, "We need a after dinner speak." And I went, "Don't say anymore. I've got your man, okay?" And I said, "Get the doc." And he went, "All right, okay." So he went and he absolutely tore Hong Kong apart, and everybody over there loved him a bit. And he came up to Glasgow, and I said, "Well, let me introduce my dad and my brother Tommy and well, my dad." So he's now my best mate. My brother Tommy's best mate. Met my dad. Anyway, 2 days later, I phoned up to talk to my dad. My mum answered the phone. I said, "Where's my dad?" And he goes, "He's away with Tommy Docherty." He's hanging about with and Tommy stayed in touch from that day on. And when he was up in Glasgow, he'd phone up my dad to go for a couple of pints. And I think, we come from the East End of Glasgow and we've got a lot in common. But, and then a while later, it was about a year later, I introduced my brother Michael. And my brother Michael, my brother's is the kind of one that's the really witty one and sharp, and became better mates with Michael than a lot of us. So Tommy Docket is from nowhere, he became great, great friends of four of us within this period of less than a year, probably, and stayed friends and kept in touch all those years. And it's something I've never actually spoken to, and I've never mentioned to anyone before, because it was just one of your mates. But I just, at the time, my brother Tommy phoned me up when we heard the news, and we were gutted about it, we were chatting about the old times. And we said, was it just us? Or was it like that with everybody's family? We don't know. But it was so wonderful. And I'm talking about, we've lost Tommy Wright, and I'm smiling the whole time, because I'm remembering what it was like. Very, very few people I've met on this planet in my life. He's been as good for him, has been as fun to be with, has so many stories, has done so much, and so much of it is self-deprecating as well. Honestly, he's one of the best people I've ever met in my life. I'm gutted he's gone, and I just wish everybody knew how brilliant a bloke he was, because there's so many little things that I said about, you know, the thing about him and the physio's wife and all the rest of it. Such a tiny part of his personality. He was some guy, man.
Yeah, like, I mean, you know, I wouldn't have realised maybe up until this week the impact he had on people, or even just how well regarded his career was. Like, you know, he would have been much before my generation, but clearly an immensely popular fella.
But before my generation, he was doing things as well, but you kind of vaguely knew at the past. But can you imagine if you had somebody who in the game had done what he'd done and also was having you all cracking up laughing all the time? You know, it's like Mourinho and Klopp, you know, it's like that famous, but all the time had you cracking up and killing yourself laughing all the time. It's almost unthinkable. Had he been born in a different era, he'd have owned the place.
Well, that's a lovely lovely way to finish it up on, Pat. And thanks a million for joining us, and a very happy new year.
Pleasure. And a happy new year to everyone. Stay safe.
Pat Nevin there joining us this evening. 73 minutes played at St Mary's. Still Southampton holding on. But every time I look down at the screen, Liverpool have the ball at their feet and they are moving forward. And just as I speak, they send it out left to Andy Robertson, cutting back inside. But Southampton getting bodies back, and just Liverpool now on the edge of the area. Oh, lovely ball in towards the far post. But it's cleared away by Southampton again. So 73 minutes, still Southampton leading 1-0. We'll take a quick break, and coming up afterwards, we'll be chatting Manchester United with Andy Mitten.
Football on Off the Ball.
With Paddy Power. Fueling the mischief in the beautiful game. Gamble responsibly. See Dunlewy.net.
All right, you're very welcome back to the football show here on Off the Ball. Neil Tracy with you up until 10 o'clock this evening. 15 minutes plus stoppage time left at St Mary's, and Southampton still holding on against Liverpool. 1-0 thanks to that early Danny Ings goal. But as I've said a couple of times now in the last few minutes, Liverpool constantly in possession, constantly going forward. But Southampton just incredibly organised and having a little go as well on the counter-attack when they get a chance as well. But we'll keep you updated between now and 10 o'clock on how that goes. We'll surely have a full-time whistle by the time the show is finished. Time to talk Manchester United now, though. Andy Mitten is joining me, and I imagine as well, and Andy Mitten with half an eye on events at St Mary's as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I wasn't watching it because I've got a young family, and I just checked the results, the score then, which I hope becomes a result, and thought, oh, hello. This is it. This is interesting. And I'd appreciate it if you don't update me with any news. I'll just assume that no news is good news. And I'll say now that I'd be happy with a draw. But my overriding feeling is how exciting it is to be in a title race again. I've never hid my allegiances, and Manchester United have not been in a title race since 2013. And I don't think most fans expected them to be in one this season. So it's come as a really pleasant surprise, not only to see United's hugely improved form, but also seemingly indomitable rivals dropping points everywhere. Liverpool were 22 points ahead of United this time last season and running away with the title. I still think Liverpool are the best team. They're the champions for a reason. I'd still even say that Manchester City have got a better squad than Manchester United, but I'd be lying if I said I've not been enjoying Manchester United, at least since that defeat in Leipzig a month ago.
Yeah, it was funny. I remember you were on OTBM the day after that defeat in Leipzig, and talk about doom and gloom. No offence, but it was a tough listen that morning. And it's something we've been speaking about with Mark Lawrenson earlier on and Pat Nevin just now. This season in particular, the narrative is just changing every fortnight, it seems. Teams are going from crisis to flying and flying from flying to crisis in the space of 2-3 games.
Yeah, I mean, I think that was a bad result, and it was a terrible opening 15 minutes for Manchester United. And if that game was played again today, I'd probably feel exactly the same. Going out of the Champions League is a disappointment for your team, especially when they'd started that group stage so well by winning in Paris and putting five past RB Leipzig. But I think the highs can be exaggerated if you want to check the mood, and the lows also. I've never felt the need to push for the case for the manager to be sacked, like many people who you see. I've always maintained and written that he's doing a good job. He's made mistakes, and at times he's right to be challenged for those mistakes, and he's got his own views on some of those mistakes. Keeping Fred on when he was to get red carded against PSG was a mistake, but he's got his own reasons for keeping Fred on the pitch. But by and large, he's doing a good job, and I think that's backed up with statistics. Manchester United are improving. The football is much better than we've seen in recent seasons, and a lot of United fans just wanted that. The football was really boring towards the end of Louis van Gaal's time, towards the end of Jose Mourinho's time. Never really got going under David Moyes, but I think it's been exciting this year. It's been a roller coaster. I think it's a nail biter when Manchester United go behind all the time in away games, but football's supposed to entertain it, and it is really exciting. There's so many positives. I don't think we're yet looking at a vintage team of title winners, but it's an improving team. It's a young team, and it's exciting watching them come together and to be part of a genuine title race, which I think United are at this moment.
I might just park what's kind of happened on the pitch over the last few weeks for a moment and just go in with the news of today. Darren Fletcher joining up with Ole Gunnar Solskjaer's coaching team, been involved with the under-16s at United since October, now joining the first team staff full-time. Is this something that had been in the offing for a while?
Well, I spoke to him on Thursday for 20 minutes and about a piece which I'm putting out tomorrow. And he's a really good talker, Darren. Really, really good. And he'd been refusing a lot of media work because he's been coaching. And I knew he'd been at Old Trafford, but I wasn't ringing him to ask what he was doing. I was asking him for his thoughts on a Manchester Derby game 10 years ago, which he played in and had a really good game in. And he was generous with his time. And then I just got another text message apologising that he wasn't able to tell me with his newfound position. That's fine. I mean, I'm a journalist. I wouldn't have written it if he told me in confidence. But again, my overriding feeling is a positive one, because I think he will bring a big skill set to Manchester United's coaching staff. I value his judgment on football matches. He's been a football addict for as long as I've known him. I can remember him speaking to him 10, 15 years ago and him asking me detailed questions about Spanish football. He knew all about United We Stand, and you know, with respect to someone like Anderson, he probably didn't. He had qualities in other areas. And I think that Darren, he's done all his badges. His playing career ended on a bit of a low note at Stoke City, and he probably needed a little bit of time away from the game. And he's wanted to get back in the game. He studies games. And one of the things he said to me was he watches the tactics so closely that he finds it difficult to watch games as a fan and to enjoy them in that way. And probably not a bad thing for Manchester United to have someone like that. And if you're looking at the coaching staff now, you've got Darren Fletcher, Michael Carey, you've got Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, you've got Mike Phelan. I think there's legs there. I think there's potential there to keep improving. I think we're seeing already the improvements, and I think there's a good buzz about Manchester United at the moment. That said, there'll be more knocks, there'll be more drop points, there'll be more social media outrage. This team's not the finished team by any stretch. But when you just said then, I'll hold back on what's been happening on the news, I thought you were going to tell me that Liverpool have scored, so I'm really glad that you didn't tell me that.
No, I will just break away very quickly and take an update from the game at St. Mary's, Southampton and Liverpool, with Peter Hood.
Southampton 1, Liverpool 0. Southampton hanging on somewhat in the second half, but Liverpool, for all their possession and dominance, haven't really tested Fraser Forster in the Southampton goal. The home side have worked their socks off, defended valiantly and kept the visitors very much at bay. They could have had another goal themselves when Theo Walcott blazed over the bar from a good position, but it's been mostly Liverpool chances in the second half which have not been taken. Southampton 1, Liverpool 0.
Just before I move on from Darren Fletcher onto events on the pitch with United, is there any indication of, kind of, has he been given a specific brief at the club, or is it just to be a general part of the coaching role that they were really pleased with what he was doing with the under-16s and maybe had an eye on him for some time and wanted to bring him in?
I think what United do is they invite former players in, or the former players invite themselves back in, and they're welcomed in, and feedback and judgments are made about them. If they fit into the environment, if they've got the head for it, if it's something they really want to do, because they're not getting salaries which are going to be anything like what they've been used to as players, but also which they might be making if they wanted to go straight into management. I mean, Darren Fletcher probably could go for a management job. I'm not saying that he's done that or wants to do that. And then if there's a good fit, if there's a good vibe about the place, then an offer tends to follow. And it's just about what the offer is, because quite often with the former players from recent times, they've made the money. It's not always financial. It's more about the time. And Darren was in big demand from the media, as I said, because he's such an articulate talker. And he's chosen to go down the coaching route. Probably the best example is Brian Kidd. Came in on like £10,000 a year in 1989. He just wanted to coach, but Sir Alex Ferguson spotted the potential. And a few years later, he just said to him, "Give us a hand with the first team, will you, kiddo?" And that was basically, "Will you be assistant manager of Manchester United?" And I quite like the way that works. It's almost like that boot room mentality that works so well at Liverpool and worked under Sir Alex Ferguson. And if someone's good, the cream rises pretty quickly to the top. I'm not saying Darren Fletcher's going to be Manchester United manager but by next week, but talent is encouraged, and if he's good, people will notice that and he will be brought into the fold. The bottom line at Manchester United is they want the first team to be winning matches and playing decent football. So I don't know exactly what his skill set is. I've talked about his tactical ability and his attention to detail in following tactics. He might be great at spotting players. I just don't know. But if he's in the environment every day where he's being judged, then he'll be given chances. And that's what's happened with Neil Ryan, who's now the coach of the 18s. He came in as a part-time coach, working for free, worked his way right up. Or Neil Wood, the current coach of the under-23s, a really impressive young man who was at United as a kid. He's a Stretford lad from close to Old Trafford, and he's good, and that's why he's become the manager of United's under-23s, because if he wasn't good, he'd be found out very quickly.
And then going back to what's happened on the pitch over the last while, 5 wins from 6, level on points with Liverpool going into this game this evening, and potentially now, if things stay the same for the next 4 minutes plus injury time, would have a game in hand over them as well. What has happened on the pitch for United over the last few weeks in comparison to when we spoke, when we had you on the show, we'll say, for example, after the Leipzig game?
Yeah, isn't life wonderful? Isn't football wonderful? Isn't it bringing joy to Manchester United fans and probably tension to Liverpool fans at the moment? I never believed that the problems were as bad as some people made out. I know for a fact United had no intention whatsoever of sacking Ole Gunnar Solskjaer. And I had editors saying to me, because I work for a few people, "Is he going to lose his job at the weekend?" And I was saying, "No." "Yeah, but everyone's saying this." And I'd say, who's everyone? Because I'm speaking to people who would tell me, "Well, you know, that's what people are saying." And I'd say, "Well, which people? Because my sources are good sources, and I've not been told by anyone, not even the slightest hint, that Ollie's going to lose his job." And that became particularly fierce after the defeat in Istanbul. And then United played well and got the win at Everton, and things have been pretty good apart from Leipzig result ever since. there'll be more bumps along the way. You can see the way Manchester United are playing games that they have got lucky. They've had a few late winners, but maybe they're creating their own luck. Team spirit's really good. I was at Everton 2 weeks ago, and I was doing it for TV, so I was sat pitch side in an empty stadium, and you could hear everything, and they scored the goal right in front of me, like 5 metres in front of me, and you could see them all huddle and score, and there was just a massive buzz there. You can see it, and I've got enough people telling me their version of what's going on from inside the club, and if the mood was bad and if things were bad, I'd relay that to you, but that's not what I'm getting told. Of course the wins help everything. It's the perfect medicine for any football team, for any football club, but there's a lot of talent at Manchester United and they were underperforming. It's all right, people seeing United as an underdog. They still had one of the highest wage bills in world football. There's a lot of top players there, and it's good that the manager's now getting a tune out of them and they're winning matches. But even now, I don't think most United fans expect them to win the league, but it's really nice to be in a title race. There's been lots of changes behind the scenes. The youth system's much better, and there's lots of reasons for optimism.
Finally then, before I leave you go, we are running out of time, but something you kind of hinted on there, the fact that nobody expects them to win the title, it's great to see them in a title race. Does the fact that they are, if there was a three-way breakaway between themselves, Liverpool and Manchester City as the season goes on, does that underdog's tag just kind of just help them out a little bit? The expectation isn't there. It's all just part of the ride.
Yeah, absolutely. But I do think they need to show something. And I wrote a piece today about this. A trophy would be really important. Even if it's the League Cup, it would boost Ollie's standing by 10% in my imaginary ratings. But I try and have a feel for what people are saying. Or the FA Cup, which is well regarded at Old Trafford and by United fans, and a day out at Wembley, hopefully with fans, or a Europa League final. These would all be really welcomed. And I spoke to Rennie Meulensteen at the weekend, and he said that Sir Alex always said, take every cup seriously, because the emotion of winning the cup has got so many positives. And I would agree with that. And if they're not going to win the league, which they're not favourites to win the league, then success in one of the cups and getting to a final, it's all progress. And I know people might say, well, how the mighty have fallen with Manchester United. Well, They have done. They have fallen. You can't pretend otherwise. But I do think that the team are getting better, getting stronger. I think the squad's in rude health. And I think the manager still wants to bring 4 or 5 players in over the next 2 or 3 transfer windows to get it closer to what he's looking like. But it's pointing in the right direction. But these are not title favourites at the moment. There will be more drop points. There'll be mini slumps along the way. Just hope that they're not as pronounced as they have been so far under Ollie, where he's gone like 7, 8, 9 games where it's looked pretty grim for him at times.
Yeah, fingers crossed anyway for Manchester United. Andy Mitten of United We Stand, thanks a million for joining us and a very happy new year to you.
Thank you.
Andy Mitten there from United We Stand speaking to us. Into injury time at St Mary's, still Southampton 1-0 up. We might have a full-time whistle by the time we come back after the break.
What type of midfield is Herrera? He's not a box-to-box. He's not defensive. He can't do a f***ing killer pass. Why is he on the f***ing pitch? What for what? See him come here and f***ing boss us at Old Trafford. This is Man United talking. See him come here and f***ing boss us. Rojo, what is he? What was his tactics? As soon as you get Rojo, just f***ing do it. We're not f***ing Stoke. We're Man f***ing United here. Watch. That was diabolical, that. Martial is playing against a f***ing centre midfielder in doubt. Take the f***ing on. Take him on and f***ing do it. We're Man f***ing United here. That was diabolical.
Football on Off the Ball
with Paddy Power, fueling the mischief in the beautiful game. Gamble responsibly. See Dunlewy.net.
The OTB Podcast Network with Green Farm on the go. Snack smart with 100% natural protein powered chicken bites.